The federal government had been sending Arizona hospitals money to help pay for treating undocumented immigrants. But that money's gone, so what now?
What's going to have to happen is hospitals will have to shift that uncompensated care that they're not collecting for these patients to other people that come into the hospitals.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, some Valley school districts will be making cuts thanks to their voters, how cities are dealing with the need for emergency food assistance.
And Pima County may tell applicants to butt out.
There are 21 states that do not have legislation or laws that protect smokers. Smokers are not a protected class. Discrimination applies to protected classes.
Plus, the future of libraries and why road officials are working to prevent wildfires.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather coming up for tonight. It'll be partly cloudy with lows in the mid-50s. Partly cloudy tomorrow with a high of 77, but then a chance of rain comes our way tomorrow night, and on Saturday, temperatures will be back in the mid-60s. Currently, relative humidity is at 41%. It's 74 degrees.
Governor Jan Brewer is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to block a lower court order that would grant driver's licenses to 20,000 young immigrants. The governor's appeal was filed today. KJZZ's Al Macias has more.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that Governor Brewer's denial of driver's licenses to young immigrants now avoiding deportation under an Obama administration policy was unconstitutional. Earlier this week, the Ninth Circuit rejected her request to review its earlier decision. Brewer is now asking the U.S. Supreme Court to temporarily put on hold the lower court's decision blocking her denial. Without a stay, 20,000 young immigrants in Arizona who have received protection under the Obama policy are closer to getting licenses. If the Supreme Court does not intervene, the state could have to begin issuing driver's licenses to the young immigrants as early as December 16th. Al Macias, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Former Phoenix Mayor John Driggs has died at the age of 87. Driggs' son, State Senator Adam Driggs, said on his Facebook page that his father had been suffering complications related to pancreatitis for more than a year. Driggs served as mayor from 1970 to 1974 and is credited with helping create the Phoenix Mountain Preserve. Driggs is survived by his wife Gail, 5 sons, 19 grandchildren, and 7 great-grandchildren.
Earlier this year, Arizona exhausted its share of a federal program that paid hospitals and some other providers back for the cost of treating undocumented immigrants. Starting in 2005, Washington set aside $1 billion for all 50 states and allocated money based on the number of apprehensions and percentage of undocumented immigrants in each state. Arizona's state money dried up at the end of March, and the last payments were made just last month. For more, we turn to Jim Haynes, Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association.
I think kind of the driver for it was the federal government is responsible for the borders, and because of that, they should bear some responsibility for the cost that hospitals bear for taking care of people from across the from other countries. Arizona received $182 million under the program.
Where did that rank as far as how much other states got?
Well, I think we were probably third. California got the most, and I don't know the exact amount, but I estimate it's about $250 to $280 million. And then Texas received a little bit more than us. I would guess they probably received $185, $186 million.
What do you think it says that other states exhausted their allocations of money before Arizona did?
You know, it's hard to say why other states would have used their monies up sooner. They received less for the most part. But I think part of it is the economy. As I look at the payments under the program, which went from, as I said, from June 2005 up until March of 2014, the payments really started to slow up. At one point, the hospitals were receiving, hospitals and other providers were receiving between $5 and $6 million a quarter. Over the last year or two, the hospitals and other providers were receiving between $2 and $3 million a quarter. I think the biggest driver for that was the economy. There weren't as many jobs in Arizona as there was before that. And I think that had an impact on it.
What does it mean for those hospitals and others that this money for Arizona is now gone? I mean, there's still a lot of undocumented immigrants who live here who presumably need medical care, and they're not necessarily eligible for health care under the Affordable Care Act.
Under the theory before, the federal government felt, since they were responsible for the borders, they should be paying for the bill for these patients. since the federal government's not going to be paying for that anymore, what's going to have to happen is hospitals will have to shift that uncompensated care that they're not collecting for these patients to other people that come into the hospitals. So the insurance companies will have to pay a little bit more, and individuals will have to pay a little bit more when they go to the hospitals.
Has there been any talk, or is there any sense that there might be a reallocation of money for this section for states that have exhausted it, or is this it?
I have not heard any comments at all. We have not heard any comments at all about putting more money into this. I like to think that as they work through the immigration and put the final rules in place, that they will consider putting some more money into this, but I have not heard anything at this point.
There has been a lot of talk in this state over the past several years about having emergency rooms and other healthcare providers basically, as critics would say, turn them into immigration officers and ask patients about their immigration status. How did hospitals and doctors go about trying to determine whether somebody was in this country legally or not?
Well, that wasn't their role. Their first role was to provide services to the patients, and that's always the first role. But they do ask questions, and they ask questions like, do you have a foreign birth certificate? Do you have a Social Security card? And they did ask those kinds of questions of the person. And plus, they ask if they have insurance, of course, and they ask where they live, all the information you would normally need in order to bill them. And hospitals did try to bill these folks, and if they receive payments, those payments reduced the amount that the federal government ended up paying.
Jim Haynes is Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Even though the recession officially ended a few years ago, the U.S. economy from the municipal to the federal level is retaining an air of sluggishness. There's greater demand for emergency services and fewer resources available to provide them. That's the conclusion of the U.S. Conference of Mayors 25-city survey on hunger and homelessness that was released today. Santa Barbara, California Mayor Helene Schneider is co-chair of the Mayor's Task Force on Hunger and Homelessness.
The issue of hunger is a growing concern because of the working poor who have homes, who are not necessarily homeless, but they're hungry. And so we are seeing that, you know, although the unemployment rate's continuing to drop, it was 7% a year ago, it's 5.8% today. We're seeing in hunger that things are rising in a lot of part of the countries in terms of people needing food assistance. The cities that were surveyed, 56% were persons and families, 38% were employed, 20.5% were elderly, and 7% were homeless. So these are people requesting food assistance. Poverty and unemployment and high housing costs all lead to hunger.
Whether it comes to increases in homelessness or people who are hungry, the budget really comes to mind for a lot of people. Is there funding? Is there going to be funding in these various cities to help provide more services to more people who need them?
Of the 25 cities surveyed, it's actually quite mixed. The budgets for emergency food purchases increased by 5%, according to the cities. So there was more money needed for food services. There was more food purchased, but it still wasn't enough. It was estimated that 27% of the demand for emergency food assistance went unmet. A third of the cities sort of thought that they needed additional funding that to meet need. The others thought that it would be pretty stable, and a couple thought that, you know, they'd be able to make better connections between the need and the services. The other thing the survey said is most cities expect demand for emergency food will increase. By 84% of the survey cities expected that.
25 survey cities, as we mentioned, and some as large, obviously, as Phoenix and Chicago and San Francisco. You're the mayor of Santa Barbara. Were there trends that were noticed in the report, that were quantified in the report, that there are any differences between those larger and smaller cities?
What the survey does show is that both big cities, small cities, urban cities, and cities in more rural areas are experiencing similar trends, similar issues. To me, what comes out of this report for both hunger and homelessness is it doesn't matter if you're in middle of the snow belt or in Sunshine, California, or a big city or small city, these issues are consistent in terms of the need.
The city of Phoenix, led by Mayor Greg Stanton, has been making a really big push to end veteran homelessness. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit and whether other cities, even your own, are interested in that as well.
The whole County of Santa Barbara, the city being a part of that, just entered into the challenge to end veteran homelessness earlier this year. And instantly by doing so, we have found that the connections we're now having with the Veterans Administration Office has improved dramatically. We are seeing results, and actually the survey is showing itself that while there may be some increases in other segments of homelessness, we're seeing a decrease in veteran homelessness. And I think it's that focused approach that we've seen in Phoenix and Salt Lake City, I think also in New Orleans, and we're starting to see in Santa Barbara. And I think the takeaway from this is to show that you got to focus on the absolute need of the individual, but it's also coordinating all the different services that are needed, whether that be about shelter or employment or mental health assistance or substance abuse, remedies, and then getting them become self-sufficient and then back on their feet.
Helene Schneider is the mayor of Santa Barbara, California. She's also the co-chair of the Task Force on Hunger and Homelessness for the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Mayor, thank you for the time today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Next week, Pima County's Board of Supervisors will vote on whether to stop hiring smokers and put a surcharge on smokers who already work for the county. Alan Bolzomi is the Director of Human Resources for Pima County.
It's been an interesting process. Pima County has been doing cessation programs and trying to educate our employees for many years on the unhealthy results of using tobacco and nicotine. The current policy that's going forward to the board next week actually started last July, I believe, when the county administrator asked me to start drafting it. We sent out a preliminary policy for review and comment to all of our department heads and the board and the unions, and we've rewritten it a number of times to get it to what's going to the board on Tuesday.
As far as current employees are concerned, how could they possibly be affected if the board approves this next week?
For current employees, I mean, we're not going to force anybody to quit smoking. Our current employees currently can take advantage of a number of healthy lifestyle discounts to their insurance premiums. So if they don't smoke, they get a $5 discount. Well, if you do smoke, you don't get the discount. Beginning in July of 2015, if it's passed by the board, we will start charging those employees that smoke and are on our insurance a 30% surcharge. Under the Affordable Care Act, we can actually charge 50%. So rather than going straight to the 50%, we're phasing it in at 30% next year, 40% the year after, and 50% the year after that.
When it comes to hiring new employees, how can the county be sure? Again, I'm going on the premise that this is approved next week. How can the county be certain that someone is not a nicotine user? And also, educate me on this as well. Is this just related to folks who actually use tobacco, smoke cigarettes? If they have patches, are those acceptable?
Patches or the nicotine replacement therapies are acceptable. Under the Affordable Care Act, again, we have to allow those to happen. So if you have an inhaler, prescribe nicotine replacement therapies are perfectly legitimate uses under the policy. If you are applying for a position in Pima County starting in July, you will have to certify and sign an affidavit that you have been tobacco-free for 12 months, and you'll also have to provide me some type of evidence, either a letter from your doctor or go out and get tested on your own. We are not going to test everybody. We don't do mandatory drug testing coming in here, but we will require that you have to certify to me somehow or to my office somehow that you are nicotine-free.
Do you have concerns at all that if this gets approved that people are going to say this is discrimination, this is unfair, so on?
It's been in the courts already. It's not discrimination in Arizona. There's 21 states that do not have legislation or laws that protect smokers. It's already been through the courts on the East Coast for those states such as Florida who have similar policies. Smokers are not a protected class, and discrimination applies to protected classes.
How important do you think it is that Pima County take this step?
This is a healthy lifestyle initiative. This is not a punish our employees or the public initiative. The whole idea is it's in the interest of public health. And, you know, as the county that's in charge or responsible for public health, we thought it was a wise move to make. The second part of it is financial. And I'll be real honest, it's financial. It's costing this country and all the employers $190 billion a year just in extra health care costs associated with smoking. The lost productivity is $150 billion. It's not small change.
Alan Bulzomi, Director of Human Resources for Pima County. That county's supervisors will vote on the smoking ban next Tuesday.
Still to come, some Valley school districts are facing budget cuts as a result of last month's election, and administrators say the decisions are not going to be easy.
Basically, we have a choice between this rock and that rock or the hard place.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. Updating Valley traffic. A couple of accidents to watch out for. 101 southbound in the East Valley at McKellips. That one's blocking the shoulder. Also a collision in the North Valley. It's I-17 northbound at Pinnacle Peak. HOV lane is blocked there. Partly cloudy skies in the forecast for tonight. We're looking for overnight lows in the mid-50s. For tomorrow, partly sunny with a high of 77. Cloudy by late afternoon and windy as well. And a chance for rain comes our way on Saturday. It's currently partly cloudy. We have 74 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by the Arizona Community Foundation, helping donors achieve their charitable goals with advice and planning, grants management, and flexible options to suit your vision. Learn more at azfoundation.org.
The Arizona Department of Transportation is testing a new pilot project allowing timber trucks to haul more weight on some state roads. It's part of a larger collaboration called the Healthy Forest Initiative. The idea has some in the timber industry excited, but as KJZZ's Carrie Young reports in the next installment of our transportation series, program critics say forest restoration programs involving commercial loggers often don't focus enough on habitat protection.
On a damp winter morning, logger Steve Reedhead navigates his large white pickup truck down a narrow forest road. He's headed to the Mogollon Rim to join the rest of his team. Once on site, he gives me a quick tour of his operation.
That's your hot saw. That cuts it. They put it in piles like this.
A hot saw is a large diesel-powered machine used to separate freshly cut trees into piles of usable timber and biomass, or material that's ground up and used as fuel.
And see, that big grapple on the back of it picks it up and it takes it to a landing.
Reedhead is a fifth-generation logger, and he's been running his company, TriStar Logging, for almost 30 years. But he says this business isn't for the faint of heart. It's labor-intensive, and profit margins are often slim.
The nature of what we do is very heavily equipment invested.
Right now, Reedhead's team is in the Apache Sidgraves National Forest in eastern Arizona, working with the Forest Service to remove select small diameter trees from the area. It's one of several forest thinning projects the agency is involved with around the state, with the goal of reducing the risk of catastrophic or extreme wildfire. But this partnership can often be a delicate balance, because small trees and the biomass they create aren't exactly big money makers for loggers.
So we worked with Eastern Arizona County's organization on coming up with a solution.
Dustin Krugel is with the Arizona Department of Transportation. He says a new ADOT pilot project allowing timber trucks to take almost 11,000 pounds of additional weight on some state roads could help.
By increasing this, it's going to allow the timber industry to clear more forests and make it more profitable for them to do this.
That's a lot of extra weight on the pavement, but Krugel says ADOT will be monitoring wear and tear on the roads.
It is a potential cost for the state. We may end up having to do some potential repairs or repaving a little bit sooner.
But he says right now, officials are considering the move to be more of an investment because each catastrophic wildfire can cause millions of dollars of damage to the state's transportation infrastructure.
We had the wildfire in 2011, we had more than $2.5 million worth of damages related to the fire. Road damage, fence damage, ditch cleaning, it runs the gamut.
Arizona State University agribusiness economist Jeff Englund thinks of this type of an investment as an insurance policy.
They're going to thin the forest, reduce the risk that they're going to have a catastrophic expense in the future. And they'll take a small expense up front. You know, any individual would do that.
But for Sierra Club Grand Canyon Chapter Director Sandy Barr, the plan focuses too much on commercial interests and not enough on restoring natural processes to an overgrown forest area, like prescribed burns.
If you have logging and then you have overgrazing and no fire, you have unhealthy forests. And so we need to shift the focus for promoting the commercial aspects and really focus on ecological restoration.
She says trucks taking heavier loads on delicate forest roads could also lead to increased erosion. Barr says forest restoration relying on commercial loggers is a good idea in theory, but adds they often lack a sufficient focus on habitat protection.
We would like to see a plan developed that is more sustainable.
The ADOT pilot project was launched in November, and while it's still too early to tell exactly how it will impact both state and forest roads, logger Steve Reedhead says he is starting to see an impact on his bottom line. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Some Valley school districts are facing budget cuts after voters defeated overrides in last month's election. That's on top of cuts to the schools made by the state over the past few years and a court ruling that found lawmakers have shorted schools on voter-approved money. Tim Ogle, executive director of the Arizona School Boards Association, says when overrides fail, budget cuts are next.
It's sad, of course, for residents and students and families in those districts because they know that what is coming next are budget cuts. And it's just an unfortunate state of affairs because our state so dramatically underfunds our schools that they have done a push-down strategy to the local communities. And if you know Arizona's demographic, you know that most of our voters are not school parents. And so it takes a forward-thinking community to realize that the greatest link to economic development is K-12 education.
So when school board members are going through the budgets, knowing in these districts in which overrides fail that they don't have that extra money, at this point, given what's transpired over the past several years, how do board members go about trying to balance the budgets while sort of minimizing the impact of budget cuts to students?
That's a great question. As you know, the state failed to honor Prop 301's inflation correction in school finance since 2009. And so schools have faced the most dramatic budget cuts in our state of all 50 states, the most dramatic budget cuts and since 2009. And the state has yet to make up for that, pending resolution, of course, of the current lawsuit. So we our member districts have already eliminated many of the more external services, and we're down to bare bones. And so what it means is bigger class sizes.
Is that generally the one place that districts can still sort of have a financial impact?
Yes, because it's just kind of a math problem. If you put five extra students in every class, then for every, you know, five or six classrooms, you are able to have one less teacher.
What do you think when you hear arguments from state lawmakers and others that there is still sort of quote-unquote fat to cut from the schools and that, you know, you can cut administrative costs, you can cut costs that don't really affect the educational outcome of students?
People that say that clearly are not informed. If you think about the students that will enter sixth grade next year have never attended a fully funded classroom because of the 2009 reductions. If you think about it that way, we're approaching half of the K-12 students. We educate 1.1 million students every day in K-12, and right now about 40%, but it's growing each year, of those students have never attended a school that was fully funded as the voters intended.
Tim Ogle is executive director of the Arizona School Boards Association. Tim, thanks.
You're welcome, Mark.
One of the districts whose override failed is the Saddle Mountain Unified School District in Tonopah, west of Phoenix. Mark Jorenstad, the district superintendent, says the override had been in place for nearly 30 years and would have provided $900,000 for career and technical education programs, fine arts, and to keep class sizes small, among other things, at the district's three schools.
One of the things we will look at is the maintaining of all-day kindergarten. We basically right now maintain all-day kindergarten without charging our parents, as some districts do, but we maintain that by having higher class sizes at grades 3 through 8.
Do you think that you'll have to increase class sizes even more as a result of this override failing?
Yes. There's no doubt we will have to have higher class sizes.
How many students do you expect to have in a class?
That's difficult to say. I would guess in 7th and 8th grade, we will be at 35 students per class, probably 6th, 7th, and 8th. In K-2, boy, that's difficult to say. We don't like to have 30 kids in K classes, but probably in 1st and 2nd grade, we may well be up to 30 kids in a class. In kindergarten, we really don't like, it's just so difficult to educate a kindergarten child with 30 in a class, but we will really strongly be looking at going to half-day kindergarten.
What kinds of cuts has your district had to make over the last several years as funding from the state has gone down and then having this override failing, sort of another whammy on top of that?
I have my business manager, Sandy Wilkins, here with me as well. When we came out to this district 6.5 years ago, at that time we had a budget of about $10 million. Now we have a budget of about $8 million. The loss of this override would be about a $900,000 cut from an $8 million budget, so it would be over a 10% cut. And that $900,000 would be the average taxpayer. When I say the average taxpayer, in our district, the taxpayer who owns an average valued home, it would cost that taxpayer about $9 per year for a $100,000 home assessed valuation.
So do you think then that given the amount that the average homeowner would have to pay in taxes and the fact that the override still failed, do you consider that a failure of communication of the district getting its message out that for this amount of money, this is what you can do for schools, or was there something else going on, do you think?
No, we feel that we did not get our message out adequately. And one of the things that it's difficult for us to get across to people and difficult for people to understand is the difference between the bond, which we passed, and this override was for maintenance and operations, which 90% of that, of course, is personnel cost, is salaries. But we did have people say, well, we just voted for you last year, and so use that money to pay the teachers, and it's hard for them to understand that we'd love to use that bond money to pay the teachers, but we can't do that.
So do you expect to try again with another override at the next election?
We're talking with, we had a committee of community members, and we're talking with them about if we should go out again, and many of them think so. But in an off year from a general election, you tend to have more just your community members. So we're looking at that. Of course, we'll have this next year to make substantial cuts. Even if we go back out, we'll have to start making those cuts. And that'll be difficult. Over the last 6 years, as I've said, we've made $2 million in cuts, so there's no easy and obvious cuts that can be made. They've all been made already, so we're now down to serious things. For example, we have no librarians in the district. We're down to really serious, as I said, looking at all-day kindergarten, looking perhaps at cutting music teachers, cutting PE. So basically we have a choice between this rock and that rock or the hard place.
Mark Jorenstad is superintendent of the Saddle Mountain Unified School District number 90 in Tonopah. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, I'm Eddie Ralph, and I am enjoying ice skating out in Cityscape. Every year they've done it out here, and so it's always looked cool. I've just never done it. So I thought, I'll jump outside my bike to do it for today. It's different than walking. It's very easy to fall. It's definitely something learned. The nice thing is everybody, I think, is kind of in the same boat. They got a lot of Christmas lights and stuff. They got the big Christmas tree, so it's kind of makes it festive, and they got a lot of Christmas music out, which is really fun. Makes you feel like you're in a place that snows, but obviously we're here in Arizona, so it's like, you know, 50 degrees outside.
That was Eddie Ralph, ice skating with friends at City Skate in downtown Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we should be on thin ice, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
Still to come, libraries are going digital and even allowing people to talk, but their core mission still appears to be the same.
It's still about people. Libraries are still about people, and it's still about connecting them to the information that they need to make their lives better.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. Still no areas of very heavy slowing in valley traffic, but also a couple of accidents to watch out for. I-17 northbound at Pinnacle Peak, that's still blocking the HOV lane. And if you're on the 101 southbound in the East Valley, look out for a collision at McKellips, that's blocking the shoulder. Valley weather for tonight, partly cloudy with lows in the mid-50s. Tomorrow morning should start out pretty typical, partly to mostly sunny. And by the afternoon, it'll be about 77 degrees, but by tomorrow night, it'll become windy, and then a chance for rain comes our way all day Saturday with highs only in the mid-60s. Currently, relative humidity is at 41%. Partly cloudy, 74 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by KPB, Boxing, Fitness, Conditioning, and Training Gym. Tailored personal and group programs for all ages and skill levels. Schedules and pricing at KeepPunchingScottsdale.com. Train like an Olympian, train with an Olympian.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jim Hawk. CIA Director John Brennan is defending his agency against accusations in a Senate report that it used inhumane interrogation techniques against terrorist suspects. In a rare news conference at CIA headquarters, Brennan said the incidents came after thousands of Americans died in the September 11th attacks in 2001.
Our government and our citizens recognize the urgency of the task. To find and stop Al-Qaeda before it could shed the blood of more innocent men, women, and children, be it in America or be it in any other corner of the world.
Brennan conceded that unauthorized methods were used against captives, but Brennan asserted the CIA did a lot of things right in a time when there were no easy answers. In an apparent effort to avoid antagonizing China, Pope Francis won't meet with the Dalai Lama, who's in Rome for a gathering of Nobel Peace Prize laureates. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports the Pope has been trying to improve relations with Beijing, which were cut when the communists came to power in 1951.
The Italian news agency ANSA quoted the Tibetan monk as saying that Vatican authorities opposed his meeting with the Pope because it might create inconveniences. The Vatican spokesman would not confirm the report, but said a papal greeting would be sent to the Nobel laureates. Meanwhile, a survey conducted by the Pew Research Center found that the Argentine-born Pope has broad support across the world from both Catholics and non-Catholics. Francis, who was trying to rid the Catholic Church of an image some see as aloof and distant from its flock, has the highest favorable marks in Europe, 84%, 78% in the United States, and in his native continent, Latin America, 72%. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
On Wall Street, traders reacted to gains in retail sales. The Dow closed up 63 points. The S&P 500 rose 9. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. The days of $100 a barrel oil are behind us for now. Oil is looking for a bottom, and suddenly this week, $60 a barrel did not look very secure. But back in 2006, $60 a barrel oil was scary enough for President George W. Bush to make this statement.
Keeping America competitive requires affordable energy. And here we have a serious problem. America is addicted to oil, which is often imported from unstable parts of the world.
Well, how does that addiction look today, especially since other oil producers, including the United States, have an even more slavish addiction to oil at $100 a barrel prices? Oil production has never been higher. It's the addiction to oil cash that may be more of the problem for some producers in what is looking like a big game of global energy chicken. Dr. Michael Weber is Deputy Director of the Energy Institute at the University of Texas at Austin. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
What do you think is going on here? Is this a blip or is something really fundamentally changing for oil producers and for the consuming economy that drives the demand?
It's hard to know whether this is a short-term phenomenon or the new paradigm, but it looks like you've got some big oil giants duking it out for market share. That's Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, ExxonMobil, all the domestic producers. All the big guys want to keep their market share, and one way to do that is to lower price.
And one interesting development is the U.S. is right in there.
Yeah, so this is part of the good news story in many respects is that the U.S. is now one of those major world competitors. We always have been a major producer, but now we're right there at the top again. And so that means some of that market share competition is really against us.
Where is the oil coming from that the U.S. is managing to pull out of the ground?
We've got a lot of it in shale formations. A lot of it's in Texas and also North Dakota. And then we're also getting natural gas out of the ground in places like Pennsylvania. So these are some traditional states. Texas has been an oil producer for many decades, but North Dakota was not a major producer a decade ago, and now it's number two right behind Texas. So there's some new locations and some traditional locations.
Does this plummet in the price of oil speak about the overall industrial demand in the world, or is it possible that oil producers are trying to squeeze somebody here, and there are any number of suspects?
I think fundamentally it's what you first mentioned, that it's supply and demand, that the demand around the world for oil is a little softer than before just because of recession or alternatives, and the supply is higher. So if you have high supply and lower demand, the prices will drop. So I think that's fundamentally what's going on right now.
But can a pain experiencing Vladimir Putin or an upset Iran move the price back up again? And can these prolonged lower prices do anything to cause Russia and Iran to change their policies in ways that some of the other oil producers might like?
Yes and yes. So producers can cut supply for a while to create a shortage that will drive prices back up. And that's a typical market response. If prices drop too much, then people who don't make money will cut off their supply or cut off their production. The supply and demand will come back into balance. Prices will go back up. So Russia or Iran or some country like that, including Saudi Arabia, could cut supply for a while, but they're not. And there are a couple of reasons why they're not. One is they need the money. Only Saudi Arabia can really withstand a price drop or a supply cut for a while, but they don't seem interested in doing either right now. So the producers could cut supply, drive prices back up. So that's one of their options, but they're not eager to do it, it looks like, right now.
And in the case of Russia, it probably does have the ability to control the price by cutting supply, but it needs the money more than all of the producers, probably.
It seems like it, yeah. It looks like Saudi Arabia has several hundred billion dollars of cash reserves or some number like that. Nobody knows the exact number. So they've got a lot of money in reserves, and it's not clear Russia has the cash reserves to withstand low prices or a supply cut for a while. So I think it'd be harder for the Russian society to withstand that kind of cut.
And, of course, the U.S. economy is healthy. This seems to look like a U.S.-Saudi organized squeeze of Russia.
If you're a conspiracy theorist, say, yeah, the United States and Saudi Arabia are teaming up to beat up on Russia, maybe there's a layer of that kind of geopolitics that might be one of the outcomes. But it also could be just a simple market share war. Certainly, Saudi Arabia doesn't really like Russia. I think the United States is pretty upset with Russia over Crimea and Ukraine right now. There are a lot of countries upset with Russia. And it's not like we're going to invade Russia or just do anything militarily that aggressive. But oil prices are one of those levers that countries have to enact foreign policy. Now, the United States can't do that because our oil companies don't respond to the United States government in terms of price and production. But in Saudi Arabia, they can.
At $60 a barrel or even $50 a barrel, does this begin to hurt U.S. companies? Does it begin to settle down the boom in North Dakota? What is it that $50 oil can buy that shuts down things that $100 oil opens up?
Yeah, at $100 oil, a lot of our shale plays are very profitable and productive, and so it's easy to raise the money you need to drill and get the oil and gas out of the ground. But when the prices are $50, $60, it's harder. The marginal plays are not as productive or profitable, so you'll start to see production shutting in. I don't know if the production's really shut in yet, but the drilling has slowed down, so there's already consequences in these shale plays in the Bakken and the Permian Basin. So at the really high prices, even the bad stuff's profitable. At the lower prices, you've got to be a little more disciplined. So we'll see some reining in of drilling in the United States. That's already happened. That is bad for the producers who make more money from the higher price and the higher production, but it's actually pretty good for U.S. consumers. So this is a winners-losers thing where there are some winners in the United States from the cheaper energy and some losers.
Is the U.S. still an oil addict?
Yeah, so is U.S. oil addict? Sure, we like oil. Oil is our number one fuel ahead of natural gas, ahead of coal, ahead of renewables, and then nuclear in that order. So oil is still our number one fuel, which is consistent with the rest of the world. So the whole world are oil addicts, and Texas is included in that. The United States is included. Our oil consumption is dropping. It has been dropping for about 5 years. This is good news, I think. So we are consuming less oil and we're producing more, which means our imports are dropping. And overall, our carbon emissions are dropping as we make the shifts to more efficient cars and alternatives. So we have an oil addiction, and it seems to be we're slowly getting it under control.
Dr. Michael Weber is Deputy Director of the Energy Institute at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Today, eyewitnesses in Nigeria say at least 30 people have been killed after twin bomb blasts struck a makeshift market in the central city of Jos. The attacks were blamed on the militant group Boko Haram, which is opposed to Western education.
The BBC has compiled a list of more than 5,000 people who were killed by jihadist groups around the world in November, and Boko Haram came in second only to Islamic State in the number of killings. The BBC's Tomi Oladipo has traveled to northeastern Nigeria to gain a rare insight into Boko Haram's methods and impact.
Towns like this one in Adamawa State have seen an influx of people fleeing the violence further north. Most of the people here have fled simply to avoid the threat. Few have come face to face with the rampaging militants and survived.
This is my left hand. They cut it with a cutlass.
This man encountered Boko Haram twice. He pulls up his long sleeve to show me his left hand, just a stump, and his right hand, which hangs limply.
They came like hunters, hiding behind the bushes. There were about 40 of them. One of them told me, "You are finished," and he cut off my hand. Then he stood up, flipped backwards, and shot in the air.
The BBC has revealed Boko Haram as one of the world's most deadly jihadi groups. It kills more civilians per attack than any other jihadi group. Suicide bombings in major towns and cities make the news. Brutal raids in villages can be even more deadly. We met one man who fled just 3 days before.
Before they enter town, they will send their agent to come and spy. They burn our church, burn our shopping complex, and we have no help from government. They didn't intervene. Even to send jet, no.
But just what is behind all of this violence? The little we know comes from Boko Haram videos, which show its purported leader and other armed men. But in July, I met a teacher of the group's radical ideology. He refused to allow us to broadcast his voice, but explained what drives this sect.
We will implement an Islamic State in the whole of Nigeria. Even non-Muslims will enjoy Islamic government. There are so many ideas in Western education that are against Islam. That is why I joined them. I want to die in that ideology. Allah says, fight those who are fighting you, Muslim or non-Muslim. If you are an enemy, we will come and attack.
The Nigerian army has enlisted the support of vigilante groups to help fight the insurgents. These spirited young people know their towns better than the military do and help root out Boko Haram members embedded within the community. I traveled to meet one of them from the city of Maiduguri, the place where Boko Haram was born.
If the army kills a group of Boko Haram fighters, the remaining insurgents go to another village and forcefully recruit youth to join their ranks. Many join the sect for money. Others are forced to join against their will.
But where does all this money come from?
It's a very low-cost insurgency. They don't require big money to do the kind of damage they are doing.
Kyari Muhammad is a researcher and professor of history who has studied the Boko Haram conflict.
They don't require aircrafts. They don't require submarines. They mostly use AK-47s, perhaps a few anti-aircrafts, which they have not even learned to use very well. It is a ragtag group, you know, running around the bush. It's more the will to fight.
A history of systemic failures by the government has given Boko Haram the edge in this conflict. But as we've seen traveling across the north of Nigeria, in this war, it's the innocent who are targeted more often than others.
That's the BBC's Tomi Oladipo.
Mesa has been experimenting for the past couple of years with a new way of operating its 911 system. Officials say it's led to faster, more cost-effective responses, and the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have awarded the city with a three-year, $12.5 million grant to expand that pilot program and collect data on how it's working. Steve Ward is Deputy Fire Chief and Program Manager for the CMS grant. He says responders are focusing more on what callers actually need, calling it a right-sized response.
We've been running these programs for about 2 years, and really it all stemmed from a little over 5 years ago when we were mandated by our chief, Harry Beck, to find some innovative and effective ways to look at how we respond to a lot of our different calls, our 911 cals. And so now we have the CMS grant, which has really allowed us to expand these programs that we've had running 40 hours a week to a 24/7 operation, which can touch a lot more of our customers, a lot more of our residents, and also do some empirical studies in cooperation with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. And it has also allowed us to expand our partnerships here within the community. So we're very happy to bring some new partners on and expand our programs.
So what kind of information are you hoping to get about how this program is working?
Well, what we really want to do is prove out what we believe we've found in the last couple of years with this is that we're really improving patient outcomes. We're providing the right service for these folks who are requiring not quite as an emergent or a less acute type situation to the 911 system and may not necessarily have to have an emergency room visit. So we're the overall savings to the system and to our community, we believe, is significant. So the Centers for Medicaid, Medicare and Medicaid have allowed us to do that empirical study with them in partnership so that we can prove out our model and maybe make it a model for other departments that have the same requirements.
So will the city be able to continue doing this once the CMS money is gone?
Well, that's one of our goals over the next 3 years is to prove that this is sustainable, and we believe it is. And so along with our partners, which are very important to us, we believe we're going to be able to sustain this model for our citizens and for our customers and for our community and possibly even expand it.
How much of being able to operate this new system is training the 911 operators and dispatchers to sort of know who they should send and how many people they should send out to an individual call?
That is a large component of it. We have done that training, and since we have been running these programs for the last 2 years, most of our dispatchers are quite familiar with how this works. Really, what it took to get them up and running to this 24/7 operation was fairly minimal, but we do obviously do that training. And we have a great staff in the communication center, and they, so far, to this point with the units we have in service with the CMS grant, anecdotally, it's been very effective.
Has the city seen any changes in the number or types of calls to its 911 system it's gotten as the state has expanded Medicaid and more people have signed up for health care under the Affordable Care Act?
I wouldn't say we've seen a change in the types of calls. We're still seeing the same types of calls. However, we have seen over the past, at least the past decade that I've looked at, we've seen anywhere from a 2.5% to 3% increase in 911 volume overall per year, and that's pretty standard for what we've seen here. And we're expecting that volume to go up just a little bit. I couldn't tell you exactly what it's going to be, but we do expect that to go up a little bit. So that's why these programs are so important to us, and the efficiencies that they bring to our department and to our city are so important to us.
Mesa Fire Deputy Chief Steve Ward. Steve, thanks so much for your time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Good afternoon. You're listening to The Show, a brief KJZZ news update. Deborah Milkey will not be retried for the murder of her 4-year-old son. The Arizona Court of Appeals opinion released today says the case will not be retried because the state committed prosecutorial misconduct. Milkey was on death row for more than 23 years before the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals set aside her conviction and sentence. We'll have more details coming up during All Things Considered. It's 74 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by A New Leaf, helping families, changing lives, accepting the Arizona Charitable Tax Credit to provide shelter and support for victims of domestic violence and their children. Learn more at turnanewleaf.org.
The University of Arizona's Knowledge River program has gotten a $500,000 grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Sciences. The more than a decade-old program focuses on teaching library science to people with a commitment to the Latino and American Indian communities. Gina Macaluso manages the Knowledge River program.
Libraries tend to be community centers, places where people congregate. And with the advent of multiple communities with multiple languages, that is another issue. So having people who can speak languages of the populations that are represented in all of our different communities has become very important.
In your mind, how have libraries evolved over the past, let's say, decade or so?
Oh my gosh, I started in libraries 30 years ago. So I've seen a tremendous amount of change. In the last 10 years, with the advent of digital collections or electronic collections, that's made a huge change in libraries. And not just public, but academic, medical libraries are facing the same kinds of things. When your collections become digital, there's no longer as many physical copies of books available or materials. And when things become electronic, there's less need for all the space. So what do you do with the space? So that's one of the kind of creative and wonderful things that's been happening that I've been seeing is this new ideas for the space. And we're seeing a lot of things around maker spaces in public libraries and also turning them into more formal and informal learning spaces.
I have to say that I'm still astounded whenever I walk into a library, for example, and see like a snack bar or, you know, a place not in an enclosed room where people are encouraged to interact with each other, because when I was growing up, food was never allowed in the library, and there was usually like one small enclosed room where talking was permitted. You wouldn't get shushed. It seems like that is totally changing now.
It is totally changing. And the space, because I think the spaces are changing. We have tremendous amounts of technology, computers for folks to use. And with that, it's the noise of the computers, the tapping of the keyboards, as well as people talking with each other about how they're using the technologies, librarians talking with folks about what they need. And around food and drinks, well, people take the books in the past home. And do you not think that they ate and drank while they were reading their books? So I think libraries saw that and realized that, you know what, it's probably not realistic if we want to be welcoming and open to all of our communities that this is okay.
Do you think that libraries are trying to sort of position themselves as community meeting spaces now, as opposed to just the place you go and you're sort of by yourself and you check out a book or you do some research and it's very quiet and then you leave as soon as you're done?
I think there are some libraries that still have that role, and I'm thinking about academic libraries. But in public libraries, it's changed very much. It is a community center where people can come. And I think with technology and also where people are able, spending more time at home alone, although they're connecting with folks, they're still alone. They still want that place where they can connect with people face to face. And I think that's what the public library has become a lot of the time. It's still about people. Libraries are still about people. And it's still about connecting them to the information that they need to make their lives better.
Gina Macaluso is manager of the Knowledge River Program at the U of A School of Information Resources and Library Science.
Lee Franklin with Phoenix Public Libraries says imposing buildings with dark, dusty stacks and shushing librarians aren't what today's consumers are looking for. At the Burton Bar branch in downtown Phoenix, Franklin says it's a much more open, inviting atmosphere.
You know, as you look at the bookshelves, they have an open feel to them, so you can kind of see from one side of the floor to the other. On both the north and the south side, that whole wall is windows, so on either side there's lots of light that comes in. You can sit and contemplate and view a different view of the city.
There are also lots of flexible spaces that can easily convert from quiet reading rooms to learning labs.
You know, we kind of offer people whatever sanctuary it is that they're looking for. So if they need to make that personal connection with other people, they have that here. If they'd like to come in and be off in a corner by themselves reading a book, we have that opportunity.
In addition to art galleries with rotating exhibits and a small business incubator, the library also offers a slate of programming directed at literacy and education. Judy Reno runs the College Depot on the second floor of Burton Bar, which helps people of all ages prepare for college.
Starting as young as middle school, all the way through current college students and adults. The majority of the students that we do serve, however, are in high school, and we help them get through the entire process of completing financial aid forms, searching for scholarships, writing and editing scholarship essays, completing the college application process, things like that.
Reno says it works both ways. The library is a place where the public can come for resources, but it takes an educated, interested community to keep the library relevant from generation to generation.
As the National Football League continues its bid to dominate television on as many nights as possible, the Arizona Cardinals make their first appearance of 2014 on Thursday Night Football this evening in St. Louis. Some critics are concerned that when teams play on Thursday after a Sunday game, player safety is compromised. Sean Tomlinson covers the NFC West division for Bleacher Report.
Football, obviously, it's a highly physical sport. There's a lot of abuse that happens to the body every Sunday. And typically for a team that's not playing on Thursday, they don't start practicing again until Wednesday. So they, of course, have team meetings, but they don't really get back on the field till Wednesday. So now you've got to play in a highly competitive atmosphere and in a game on Thursday already. You've got that much less time off. Now, typically they build in a bye week to get some extra rest in there to try and even things out. And then, of course, on the other end, after the Thursday game, you've got that much more time. But regardless, still, that time from Sunday to Thursday is very brief, and it's very taxing on the body.
I know we can't really put anything past the NFL, as successful as the league has been, but is this going to be it? Is Thursday, Sunday, Monday going to be it? Or can you anticipate at some point they're going to try to jump into college football territory on Saturday or Friday or Wednesday, anything like that?
I hope not. One of the best things about football and what makes it so borderline addicting to many of us is the aspect of Sunday. Sunday is a day when you can sit and just devour football all in one time, and there's sort of a novelty aspect of it. Every game is so intensely meaningful on that day, and you can switch between 10 of them, and it draws you in and soaks you in, and before you know it, it's midnight and you've watched 14 hours of football. but then when you spread it out over an entire week, suddenly it becomes saturated. And it sounds impossible right now, as popular as the league is, but eventually if you keep dumping more of a product onto people, maybe they grow a bit tired of it and they go on to something else.
Sean, are you going to be one of those people who believes in the Cardinals, or one of those guys that they'll put on the bulletin board that doesn't believe in the Cardinals? Are they going to win tonight or no?
I don't want to give any bulletin board material. I'm not sure if I've advanced quite to that level. I think it'll be a very close and highly contested game, but I just think the strength of this Rams defense and what this pass rush is doing, that may be a little bit too difficult to overcome tonight.
Sean Tomlinson covers the NFC West division for Bleacher Report. The Cardinals-Rams game starts tonight at 6:30.
And be sure to be with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. Coming up on the show, a new way for ASU students to get their prescriptions filled. And Arizonans are apparently not a bunch of braggers. Those stories and much more coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show. And just ahead on All Things Considered, much more on the Deborah Milkey ruling.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, and Aubrey Abril are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias, executive producer, John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have some good story ideas, what's going on in your neck of the valley. The show at KJZZ.org. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HG. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.